Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Now, in March this year, the UK government passed a new law allowing gene-edited food to be developed commercially in England. It's a controversial subject and one which has its supporters and its detractors. Those in favour say it'll improve food security, making it easier to develop hardier crops that will help us meet one of the challenges of climate change. Critics fear as yet unknown, unintended consequences for the food system and the environment. We're talking about CRISPR gene editing technology here. CRISPR stands for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats of genetic information that some bacterial species use as a part of an antiviral system. But I guess that doesn't really explain that much. Basically, gene editing involves sections of DNA being snipped out, which makes it different to genetic modification, in which a section of DNA is added, sometimes from a different species. In 2021, Sicilian Rouge tomatoes, which are genetically edited to contain high amounts of GABA, which can have a calming effect, have been legally sold in Japan alongside gene-edited sea bream, where more of its flesh is suitable for sushi. Does it pose any dangers? Well, researchers say that all food is rigorously tested and that GM crops, which are slightly different, have been consumed by billions for over 25 years with no ill effects. Despite this, GE, genetic editing, is banned in the EU and some other countries, including Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. So what does the new law actually allow for? What safeguards are in place? And what does all of this mean for the food industry? In this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast, I interview a key figure in the introduction of the Precision Breeding Act. Professor Gideon Henderson is Chief Scientific Advisor at the UK Government's Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA. Professor Gideon Henderson, welcome to the podcast.
Hi there. Nice to join you.
So let's start with an update on exactly where we are with gene-edited crop legislation in England. What's changed? What can food producers and farmers do now that they couldn't do before?
So as of a couple of weeks ago, the Genetic Technologies Precision Breeding Bill got royal assent and became an act and therefore became law. And what that law enables people to do is to use the tools of gene editing to mimic the process of natural breeding and develop crops in the first instance that use those techniques to build better crop varieties. And eventually that will be true for livestock as well, but not immediately.
And let's just set out the difference. What's the difference between gene edited and genetically modified? And is the distinction important?
There is a difference. I mean, genetic modification is a term that was widely used for decades before, but gene editing, a new set of tools that came along really in the last decade or so, which enable very precise cuts and snips to be made in the genetic material so that we can edit much more precisely than we could before. It's a different set of technologies that have developed through gene editing. But actually, in the way that we've defined the new law in the UK, we're trying to be technology agnostic because these technologies are always evolving and changing. And what the new act enables is the use of any genetic technology as long as it mimics the process of natural breeding that you could do through natural breeding anyway. So in the UK law, the distinction between GM and GE is actually slightly smaller. It's whether the process mimics the things you could do by natural breeding or not, which is the important distinction.
So it's effectively an acceleration of a process that could have happened by selective breeding.
An acceleration, yes, and also making it more precise, because the process of breeding itself, which of course we've been doing for many generations since the birth of agriculture, is one where you sort of rely on random changes and you select the random changes and crossbreed them again to try and get the thing you want. And that's an imprecise way of doing things. As we've understood more and more about the genetic makeup of our crops, we're able to more precisely say, well, that's the thing we need to change. And then we'll get the crop variety that we want. So we can do it more precisely. And partly because of that, we can do it more quickly as well.
And what will this enable?
It'll enable a lot of stuff. And I'm excited about it, first and foremost, as an environmental scientist, because it'll enable us to build crop varieties which are good for the environment in at least two ways. One of which is that it will enable us to build crops that are naturally resistant to pests or diseases. So we'll be able to use less herbicide, less pesticide on our crops, and we know that those pesticides often have negative environmental consequences. So that'll be an improvement to the environment, as well as, of course, if your crops are not vulnerable to those pests, it will enhance productivity and be more profitable for farmers. And then the other environmental consequence that I'm particularly keen on is it will mitigate some of the effects of climate change. If we're able to grow crops that have better uptake of nutrients, we'll be able to use less nutrients, which are and themselves part of the greenhouse gas problem, and we'll be able to build crops that are more resistant to future climate change, more drought resistant or more heat resistant in the future.
And what are the limits? What cannot be done under the new legislation?
Well, broadly speaking, stuff that you couldn't do through natural breeding. A sort of prime example of that is what's called transgenic changes, where you take a piece of genetic code from one species and you insert it into the species of interest. So you insert something which has nothing to do with, say, wheat, and you put it into your wheat variety. That's not allowed, that sort of transgenic process. We know that that sort of process can be also used for quite positive outcomes, and we know that from work in many settings, but that is not allowed in the UK context according to this new bill. It will only be things which could be done by natural breeding, where the genetic information is broadly that which is in the same species already.
Now, this is an emotive subject for a lot of people. You know, the lobby against GM food has been particularly vociferous. And in Europe, GM is pretty much not allowed. Have you had to tackle a lot of problems from opposition to this? And what risks did you consider when reaching the decision to allow gene editing to go ahead?
Yeah, there's a lot in that question, actually. I could talk for a long time. I'll try and unpack it a bit at a time. There is a lot of public unease, actually quite a lot of public lack of knowledge as well about this subject. And that's one of the reasons why we're very keen to move carefully through the process so that the public are clearly informed and coming with the changes. There was a consultation early on, and we've continued to engage wherever we can through media outlets. And I've done quite a lot of speaking in various contexts to make sure that we're talking and communicating and listening to people's views about this. We've also done quite a lot of polling during that process, both my own department, DEFRA, but FSA, the Food Standards Authority, and other government departments and other organisations have polled. And in general, particularly for plants and for crops, the public are actually really pretty happy about the use of gene editing to make these sorts of changes, and there's pretty broad support. So just to use one example, in a piece of FSA research recently, 54% of people thought it would be acceptable to use precision breeding for plants versus only 16 who were opposed to it. So 54 versus 16 is a pretty big margin of people who are quite supportive if it's used in plants. Mm. I should say that the ratio is more even for livestock than it is for plants. But people are generally quite supportive, actually. You also mentioned in passing something about the fact that it's largely still banned in Europe, where all of gene editing is packaged up with GM. The Europeans have also said that they consider that their legislation is not fit for purpose at the moment and have consulted and are actively considering how they will change the legislation around gene editing as well. So they're moving in the same direction that England has moved recently. And then your sort of big question, I think what you were leading up to in your question was around risk. What are the risks that we needed to think about? And I think the two big categories of risk that were really important to consider are risk to the environment and risk to humans through eating, risks from food. And in both those areas, we've looked at them in a great deal of detail. That's the thing we've been most scrupulous about, is to think what are the risks to the environment, make sure we've got a process in place to minimise those risks, and similarly with food, to make sure that the food people continue to eat is safe and nutritious as it is at the moment.
Now, Is it frustrating for you to have to deal with opinion when it comes to, you know, versus the potential economic and environmental benefits of something like gene editing? Because, as you said, the public isn't necessarily well informed about how these things work. I would say people in Europe are terrified of GM and not necessarily understanding the basics of how it works and what the risks are. So has this process been a hair-pulling frustration for you personally?
No, I can say that honestly. It's not been absolutely recognised that you don't want to move forward with this sort of technology, this sort of science, without people understanding and being comfortable with it. And that's, again, one of the reasons why we've gone very carefully, only to move on things that are like traditional breeding, only to move in the first instance on crops, making sure that we're not running too fast ahead of public opinion and comfort. And people have got concerns for legitimate reasons. And it's important to communicate and talk through those and make sure that those concerns are laid before we move forward. I should say also that in the last few decades, since the GM debate that was really heated in the 1990s and early noughties, that the public knowledge about genetics and what we can do with them has advanced really quite a long way. Mm. And we've certainly seen that as we went through the COVID pandemic. People got quite used to hearing about genetic variants. Most of us had some sort of vaccination, which often had been genetically altered and had used gene editing to build it. So we got comfortable with the benefits that come from understanding of genes. I think the public are more ready now than they were a few decades ago to embrace those benefits for crop as well.
Yeah. So now you mentioned earlier on that, that this may pave the way for gene editing in farm animals in the future. I mean, is this likely, do you think? Is there an appetite for that, both within society and within the food industry?
Yeah, well, there's some big positives that we could get from gene editing of livestock, and positives for their welfare, positives for the food system, positives for the environment. But unlike crops, where gene editing it mimics breeding and breeding is already used only for good, breeding of animals can lead to negative outcomes. You can breed things that are you're so focused on creating more productivity from your animal that you lead to negative welfare outcomes from the animal. It grows so quickly that it can't stand up or something. Those sorts of negatives are possible through traditional breeding approaches. Yeah. So a use of gene editing, which would accelerate and make those processes more quicker, has the potential to accelerate negative as well as positive outcomes from animal breeding. And that's why the Act that's just passed doesn't allow gene editing of animals in the first instance. It allows for them in the future, but only when we've really got a full understanding of how we would regulate to make sure that the animal welfare issues are well looked after as precision breeding is used for those approaches.
Now, this new law only applies to England, and there has been a little bit of a raucous about this, but Wales, Scotland and Ireland haven't approved the practice yet. They may never do, who knows. How much consideration was given to the impact that this new law may have in those countries, bearing in mind that there's no border between England and Wales and you know, crops and obviously the sale of those crops can travel?
Well, quite a lot of consideration was given to that from a few different angles. I should say that each of those other nations is being cautious about precision breeding for slightly different reasons. They've all got quite a different position. So, and we have been aware of that and in active conversation. And I've been in conversation about the science and others have been in conversation about the policy directions and the trade implications. From a scientific point of view, there's really broad agreement across all of the UK nations about the science. There's not disagreement about that. And there's also agreement about the potential benefits that come from the use of precision breeding in this way. That some of the things that we've had to then look at as the policy of the countries has separated, having included what happens at the border if you're growing the stuff. So if you're growing stuff in England and not in Wales, is there a possibility of things moving across the border as a consequence? And that's something we've thought carefully about and been reassured about. Then there's the question about the research that is being done, where there are some really strong institutes in Scotland and Wales that are doing gene editing research and building new precision bred organisms. So there's a question about how much of that research they can do in those countries, even though they might not be able to market the products that come from them. And that's obviously a conversation that I've been, as a scientist, very involved in. And then there are the questions about trade and how much we'd be able to move stuff across the borders within the UK. And that falls somewhat outside my area, so I can't comment on it so much. But I think there is a sense that at least as Europe evolves its policy, we're likely to see movement in Scotland and Welsh policy as well.
So you must be connected with the world of this kind of technology around the rest of Europe. Do you think that the EU will begin to change its stance? And do you think that gene editing will come to the home nations and possibly to the EU as well in the near future?
I think so. I mean, Scotland's position has been pretty clear that they want to tie themselves to the EU position. So your question really is the EU going to move? And as I said earlier, I mean, they are on record, they've published something saying they consider the current regulatory and legislative environment in the EU to be not fit for purpose on gene editing. And they are actively thinking about how to change that. I do talk a lot to scientists across Europe and globally. I was actually at a meeting last week where I had the opportunity to talk to four different European countries about their stance on gene editing in some detail. And most European countries have really moved quite a long way towards thinking that use of gene editing in an appropriate way is merited and should be done. But it's a very political issue. And as you've touched on earlier, some countries are still thinking that this is we're not quite ready to move. I think in Europe at the moment, with the Green Party having significant sway in Germany, that's probably the country that's got the most unease about it. But I think we'll see movement in Europe in due course.
Yeah. So why does DEFRA see this as such an important move for the food industry? What doors would it open?
Well, lots. I mean, I've already talked about that I think it's a huge environmental benefits to be had from this. There are benefits also to human health, making crops where you remove the allergens or you make them higher in a vitamin or higher in a beneficial enzyme. So there's human health benefits that we haven't touched on in this conversation yet. And there's also productivity benefits that we can grow more stuff on a smaller land area. And that enhances our ability to do other positive things like habitat creation elsewhere in the UK. Yeah, in that last the productivity argument, we've got farmers do well because they can grow more, they're more productive. And the UK environment does well because we free up land and can use it for positive environmental outcomes. So those are some of the reasons. From a scientific point of view, the UK is also genuinely very good at this field. We've got some leading institutes globally who can take some of these technologies, are already taking some of these technologies and making really clever crops with them. So there's a benefit for our science system, the sort of idea of the UK as a science superpower, us using our scientific ability to make better products and change the world for the good is realised through this ambition. And of course, you can make more money if you're selling things in the UK and overseas.
Yeah, and you mentioned the human health benefits. Can you elaborate on those a little?
Well, some of the first products that are coming to market elsewhere are of this type. So the tomato in Japan, for instance, that has a heightened level of particular enzymes, which are thought to be healthy and not to cause, help you not to get cancer. And that's being marketed very explicitly. This is a precision bred organism. We've made it specifically so that it's healthy.
Oh, that's actually part of the marketing materials that goes with it.
They particularly designed it to do that. I think we're going to see that in the US and in our country as well, that some of the first things to market will be things where people have done something quite explicit with precision breeding to give you a health benefit, and therefore they want to say that and be positive about
That'd
it.
That'd be really interesting, yeah.
Another example I can say in past, I know that there's a product close to market in the US, which is a leaf, and which is normally cooked to remove the bitter taste, and they've edited to remove the bitter taste so it can be cooked, so it can be eaten as a salad ingredient, and that's apparently very tasty, and it's certainly very nutritious, even more nutritious when it's not cooked, salad leaf. So that's that's the sort of thing we'll see that marketed, I think, as a precision bred organism when it reaches that stage in the US and here.
Yeah. I wonder what else might be in the pipeline in that. So the ones that I know of that are marketed are the Sicilian Rouge tomato in Japan, and also I believe there's a sea bream that has a higher yield of fish for sushi. But I don't. Do you know of any others that are particularly interesting?
Well, the ones that are sort of in the pipeline that you may or may not have heard about. One of which is that in the UK, Rothamsted are actively doing research into can we grow wheat which has a lower asparagine content. And there's asparagine that when you cook it, particularly if you burn wheat or brown it, generates a cancer, a carcinogenic product. Mm. So that's one area where we might be able to build something which is better for human health. There's quite a lot of media attention recently around tomato, which has enhanced vitamin D content and therefore beneficial through eating that. That's quite a long way from market, but it's been demonstrated to work, and we understand the genetics behind it. And then there's also a lot of work going on about can we remove some of the allergens or toxins from foods. So yeah, things like taking gluten out of wheat or taking the allergens out of peanuts are two areas of active interest.
Yeah. I mean, there seem to be relatively few products around as yet. I guess these things take a fair amount of time to create. And also, if there's not a regulatory environment or legislative environment within which you can ever market them, why would you start? Do you think that there will, as of a month ago, there will begin to be a roller coaster, an avalanche of new research projects and then products on the shelves? Are we just seeing the industry cranking up?
Well, I might start by saying that there is already quite a lot of activity in other countries. And you've mentioned Japan already, which is a country that enabled gene editing for crop development some time ago. Argentina did similarly, and they've had a really vibrant research environment as a consequence of that. We can look at them. I've often looked to them as an example of the types of products that are being researched and how you can set up a regulatory environment. In the UK, we do actually have really quite a lot of research going on in this area already. There's quite active research, particularly on wheat and tomatoes in Rothamsted, in the National Institute for Agricultural Botany, NIAB outside Cambridge. Also really good work going on in the Roslin Institute in Edinburgh around livestock. So there's some really strong institutes and departments already working in the UK on this, not just in England, across the UK. And now that there's a sort of signal that these are things you can actually take to market in the UK as well as in some other countries around the world, I think we will see an escalation. And we're very likely to see more private funding for this. So at the moment, some of the work is funded by public purse, public R&D spend. Then we're going to see much more investment in the UK from private breeding companies and biotech companies.
Yeah. Will gene-edited foods have to be labelled so consumers know what they're buying, or is that part of the bill?
No, they will not have to be labelled. And we can explore why that is in a minute. But there are a couple of things to say about that, one of which is, as we've mentioned already, some products will probably choose to label themselves, and that's certainly possible. And retailers may also choose to label. And there will be a notification system, so there will be a list of the varieties that have been generated through precision breeding approaches. So that it will be possible to track back and see is the variety I'm eating a gene-edited product or not. So there will be some ability to trace, but the products in the supermarket will not have a new label added to them to define how they were bred.
And are people worried about that? Is there a sense amongst the people in opposition to gene editing that's a fundamental problem?
I think that people have expressed concern. I wouldn't go as far as saying it's a fundamental problem, but people are saying, well, that the consumer has a right to know information, and therefore we perhaps should label. In general, though, labelling is reserved for products where you know that there is something distinctive about them, so the product is different or from another, or it contains something that you need to know about. And that's what is important about labels, is giving consumers information that is relevant to them and describes the product in a way that differentiates it from others. But actually, use of precision breeding in a way that mimics traditional breeding will lead to products that are identical to those from traditional breeding. So the mechanism by which it's produced won't lead to any change in the product that you're eating relative to things you could have bred.
Yeah.
And we don't, we already don't label them. I mean, there are lots of different approaches to traditional breeding, including some that are, you know, quite scientific and quite lab-based. And we don't label all of those at the moment in supermarkets. Because we're using precision breeding, we shouldn't start labelling that either.
Yeah. Now, I'm interested in whether or not Brexit has had an impact on the introduction of this new law. Could we have passed this law if we were still in the EU?
So I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is no, we could not have done. And when gene editing was first considered by the European Court of Justice, the UK's position, and in fact many other European countries' position also, was that we shouldn't consider all of gene editing approaches as if they were GMOs. So the UK was resistant to this, but at the time the ECJ, European Court of Justice, said, well, we're going to lump all of gene editing in with GM. And as a consequence of that, because we were part of the EU, we could not have made the changes that we've made in the last couple of years.
Yeah. And last question really is, well, I've got one other question, but when are we likely to see gene-edited foods on the shelves? I mean, you know, who really knows, but give us your best bet. Is it going to be 6 months? Is it going to be 3 years?
I don't think it'll be quite as quick as 6 months. And that's because there's still some, as a consequence of the law that's already passed, there are some other things we need to sort out as a consequence of that. The notification scheme, exactly how you approve things to definitely that this is a precision bred organism, it's not a GMO. We're going to have to make sure that there's the process in place to set that out. And the Food Standards Agency are going to have to make sure that they've got their processes in place for before it can become marketed as a food or a animal feed. So those processes will take some months longer before we'll see anything hit the shelf for sure.
So we need the regulatory infrastructure in place anyway before it can happen.
That's right, which will follow as a consequence of the new law that will now follow and be set up. And that will take some months, 6 months or so, I think, to realise. Then I think we could start to see some products that have been developed in other countries come to market reasonably quickly, because if they've already been demonstrated to be safe and we know that they work and they're well tested, then bringing them into the UK market could be relatively easy. And then we'll see things that we're working on ourselves in the UK, including some that are actively being researched already. We'll see them come to fruition, I think, in a couple of years at the earliest.
Yeah. Now, and lastly, you know, this is an emotive subject for many people, or certainly GM has. And as you say, there seems to be a lot more acceptance of GE. But it's emotive. Do people think that passing legislation on GE will begin to pave the way for changing legislation on genetically modified foods and therefore, you know, allowing them into our food chain on a much greater level?
Yeah, the short answer is no. I mean, this is not a stalking horse for an immediate piece of subsequent legislation. It's a, you know, careful, stepwise process. Moving only now to enable technologies that mimic the process of traditional breeding, let them mature in the market, and that will take years to come. And we'll see how the public debate and the public feeling is about this, and indeed how the science develops. But it certainly, it won't be in my lifetime as a chief scientific advisor at DEFRA, and it won't be in the current government's lifetime either that we'll see any further move towards GM. That this act has already enabled, I think, a large amount of interesting science to come to bear with a lot of positives for crop development and eventually livestock development. And we can get on with doing that. There's no need to move further.
Yeah, fantastic. OK, well, I look forward to seeing the first things on the shelves. I have to say, I will be happy to buy them, but I know that other people will think very differently. So, Professor Gideon Henderson, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, we'd like you to join us in our new initiative, Sustainable Food Week, where we're celebrating the influential people changing the future of food. There are a number of ways to get involved. We've got a digital digest, an in-person forum, and podcast opportunities. It's happening between the 18th and 24th of September. But if you want to be involved, you need to act now. Find out more on the Food Matters Live website or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.